And I'll discuss the results and applications that I get using this method. Before then, going on to discuss two-particle interference, so the interference of two particles that are simultaneously present in the Mach-Zehnder interferometer, and in particular, I'll be interested in the possibility to generate EPR pairs in such a two-particle interference experiment. So the theoretical method to describe this is a scattering approach that involves two particles, spin-dependent version of that, and I'll show you that one can actually obtain entanglement in such a system from if one also introduces a projective charge measurement. I'll conclude at the end. Okay, so quick reminder about Rushbaugh spin splitting. Rushbaugh spin splitting occurs in semiconductor heterostructures. Experimentalists now routinely create two-dimensional electron systems by combining semiconductors with different band gaps, and in such a heterostructure, the two different band gaps are accommodated by a band bending that is occurring in the system, which essentially results in the textbook results in the realization of the textbook example of a 2D quantum well. As we know, bound states exist in these quantum wells, and electrons that are supplied by dopants fall into that and live in these two-dimensional bound states. Now, most generally, these quantum wells actually are, as I try to sketch here, asymmetric. So there's a broken inversion symmetry in the growth direction for that heterostructure. And we learn that whenever inversion symmetry is broken, we have spin orbit coupling present in the system. So in fact, in the Hamiltonian that describes the bent electrons, there's a term that looks exactly like the spin orbit coupling term that one obtains from a low, basically velocity expansion of the Dirac equation, except that the mass of the electrons has to be replaced by the effective mass, and the energy scale with which to compare the external potential to, which in the vacuum case is the electron rest energy, has to be substituted by the gap energy of the semiconductor. So the spin and the momentum of electrons are coupled wherever we have a gradient of such an external potential, which is essentially nothing nothing but a such a space-dependent external band bending. Now, so the electrons that live in this two-dimensional bound state feel this asymmetry and therefore are subject to a spin orbit coupling, and their implicit momentum and basically their spin are coupled with a strength that can be parameterized in terms of a wave vector scale, KSO, which is the inverse of some length scale, typically called spin precession length, and essentially this strength KSO, this scale KSO, measures the degree of asymmetry in that sample. So it becomes larger if you make this quantum well more asymmetric, which, for example, can be done by applying voltages to an external gate voltage. Now, what are the consequences of having such a spin orbit coupling present? It introduces a splitting of the energy, because it actually results in a lifting of spin degeneracy. So the Fermi surface is split into two circles, different radii, and furthermore, also the spin direction and the orbital motion of electrons are coupled. So for electrons to be in eigenstate, they actually have to have their spin be polarized perpendicular to the propagation direction. So as a result, then, if we inject electrons at some particular spin state, just a general spin state, spin precession will occur. And the such a situation can, for example, be realized in a setup where we have a two-dimensional electron system with Rushbaugh spin splitting present, sandwiched between two magnetic contacts, as shown in this slide. If the magnetization in that contact, in those contacts, is such that it is parallel to the propagation election of direction of electrons between those contacts, then if we apply voltage, electrons that are injected will have their spin polarized parallel to the propagation direction, which is not an eigenstate. Rather, this is such a state of an injected electron. It's a superposition of the eigenstates that have spin polarized perpendicularly to the propagation direction. And because these two states have different Fermi wave vectors, when this electron then moves along between the contacts, we will actually observe that the electron spin precesses, and depending on how fast it actually precesses, it will either arrive with a spin direction that can be accommodated as a majority electron or not. And depending on this, we will have a large or small resistance in the system. So for example, in the situation that I've drawn here, the electron has rotated its spin to be a minority electron in the analyzing contact. However, by adjusting the gate voltage, back gate voltage of this 2D electron system, we can actually change the asymmetry in that quantum well, and therefore the spin orbit coupling constant essentially makes the electron spin rotate faster, and in that case then the electron when it arrives at the analyzing contact will be a majority electron and be easily accommodated, and we will have a low resistance in the system. So this system was suggested as a basically an electronic analog of an optical modulator, but is more fashionably called a spin transistor these days. And in fact, the sort of electrical control of electron spin precession has been demonstrated in a slightly different sample. So those are actually plots of basically the spin polarized density in semiconductor epi layer, where due to applying stress, experimentalists have actually realized something similar to Rushbar spin splitting in the system, and have actually visualized or measured, and therefore can visualize the precession of an injected spin between up and down, and in fact also demonstrated that the precession can be precession wavelength, if you wish, can be enhanced by applying a stronger strain, which would correspond to a larger asymmetry in the system.
It had been earlier done already by the Absalom group, right?
The spin, the direct, I mean, certainly with magnetic field applied, this is, you know, with strain.
Yeah, but not also without magnetic field. The spin precession of an accumulation.
Where is it through the system, I think?
Yeah. And the electric field control of that as well?
This is a 2D system. Yes.
This is an epi layer, yeah.
Okay, it was a 3D system. Yeah, I don't think there was a 3D system. But it was a 3D system.
Yeah. But it would have to be rushed by also spin out a couple of them.
Okay, so this is one ingredient that I will build on later on, namely the Rushbar spin splitting. Second one is the interference of electron waves. All do experiments in introductory physics where we observe the interference of light by projecting the interference fringes onto some some screen, and we essentially see this interference occurring by having a modulation in the light intensity. Now, the analogous observation in phase screen electronics is to look for a modulation of the conductance, for example, as a function of gate voltage or magnetic field. So the conductance modulation is an exact analog of the basically interference fringes in quantum optics. And that has been observed. Celebrated examples are, for example, the Aronoff-Bohm oscillations, where I'm showing you here an experiment where the current through a ring, studied as a function of magnetic field, and the interference due to electrons obtaining different phases when moving through the different two different arms of the Aronoff-Bohm interferometer leads to these conductance modulations, which can be affected by a gate voltage that selectively affects and therefore changes essentially the phase of electrons moving through one of these interferometer arms, which is allowed the experimentalists to actually change the interference from constructive to destructive just by applying this such a gate voltage. Also, the archetypal Young's double slit experiment has been done with electrons. Electrons were basically injected from some collector, some emitter, and collected at some collector, and were made to move through such a double slit structure, again, where the phase of electrons moving through one of the arms could be selectively affected, and beautiful conductance modulations were found as a function of magnetic field that is applied perpendicular to the structure, and also as a function of the voltage that it essentially introduces a phase shift in one of the near one of the slits. And also more complicated quantum optics experiments have been done with electrons, for example the Hendberg-Braun-Schiff experiment, which deals with higher order coherence, two-particle coherence, and to do that experiment, people had to actually create some analog of a beam splitter for for electrons. So interference and coherence of electrons has been observed and measured in electron systems. Now in the following, I'll be particularly interested in discussing the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So therefore, let me remind you of what it looks like. Essentially, the Mach-Zehnder interferometer is a more sophisticated version of the double slit experiment. And incident light beam is split at a beam splitter into two partial waves, two partial beams, which are reflected at perfect mirrors and then made to interfere again at a second beam splitter. And we monitor the output intensity at two detectors, detector 1 and detector 2. Now in a setup that I'm showing here, where the optical paths in the two interferometer arms is exactly equal and no other physical object is in the way of these beams, then we will always have constructive interference at the output leading to detector 1, whereas we have destructive interference leading at the output leading to detector 2. So detector 1 will always be the light detector, detector 2 will always be the dark detector, except if we make some change, for example introduce some phase shifting material in one of the arms, etc., which will then lead also to the detector 2 being having some finite intensity. And here's a picture just of this Mach-Zehnder interferometer, sort of a commercially available one, which is, you know, Mach-Zehnder interferometer is really the bread and butter device for quantum optics these days. However, the electronic version of Mach-Zehnder interferometer has been realized only very recently, essentially using quantum point contacts as beam splitters. And for the interferometer arms, essentially, people use the quasi-one-dimensional conducting channels that form at the boundary of a 2D system when it's placed in a strong perpendicular magnetic field, these so-called quantum Hall edge channels. I don't want to go into great details about this, this structure, which has many beautiful aspects, except saying that also in this system, then, as a function of magnetic field and also of gate voltages, which change the phase of electron waves in one of the Mach-Zehnder interferometer arms, the experimentalists actually observe beautiful interference fringes. Okay, so what I'm interested in is to bring together electron interference and spin, and the interference in real space can affect the spin state of charge carriers, in particular if we have spin orbit coupling present. So there have been some earlier suggestions that essentially dealt with ring-like geometries. So one from the NTT group, where they discussed the interference of electron waves in a ring structure that has tunable Rashomon spin splitting present. And also these two authors discussed how they can actually use a ring resonator with a local Rashomon spin splitting present to enhance the function of such a three-terminal device to act as a spin filter. Now, there have been experiments, some experiments also in the ring structures. I only want to refer to very recent experiments, which, in fact, if you go to the webpage of the KITP spintronics program, you might find more details about. Nita Sun was here earlier and has actually talked about these experiments. Essentially, the NTT group has looked at the conductance or transmission through a array of rings, basic network of rings, built such a sample. Now, in such a system, they basically realized the interference of time reverse path in such a structure. It's not quite a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Essentially, they're looking at the interference effect of backscattering, where when an electron enters this ring structure, it can move basically on one of two. It will be have waves, partial waves that move on time reverse path, clockwise or counterclockwise. And as we have heard from Volodya's talk just before, there is typically constructive interference for these time reverse paths, which leads to enhancement of backscattering. However, if we apply magnetic field, then this constructive interference is spoiled, and in fact, for such a structure where we have interference between these time reverse paths, it's actually when a flux quantum, half a flux quantum is enclosed by these paths in real space. And with spin, splitting present, however, this interference actually also becomes dependent on the strength of spin orbit coupling. And this is exactly what these experimentalists have demonstrated. They have looked at these Altshuler-Wolanow-Zwieback oscillations, essentially tuning the resistance minimum at some particular gate voltage into a maximum and vice versa, just by adjusting an external gate voltage, which essentially adjusted the strength of the spin orbit coupling and therefore has basically affected the interference of the spin partial waves in this ring structure. Okay, so on to my particular interest, namely the spin-dependent electron interferometry that we can do when Rochebach spin splitting is present in a small structure where electrons move phase coherently. So the first question is whether this can actually be realized, and just want to stress that the basic building blocks for building such a creating such a Mach-Zehnder interferometer are available, have been realized. So waveguides, beam splitters, mirrors, etc., have all been realized in semiconductor nanostructures. Also, the tunable spin splitting is realized experimentally. Early on, groups have shown that indeed the idea that we can adjust the strength of spin orbit coupling by applying external gate voltage actually works. And so this ingredient is there as well. And so that has motivated us to look at a particular model for an electronic Mach-Zehnder interferometer with spin-dependent interference. Quite ideal. This is, we consider a single one-dimensional subband, essentially being the waveguide for our electrons in the structure. We look at the situation where the beam splitters are symmetric and ideal, and also that the mirrors are ideal as well. And essentially, the way to look at the transport of electrons through such a phase coherent structure is that it is a transmission problem for the electron probability waves. So we characterize the structure by in quantum mechanical input amplitudes, and essentially each of these elements can be characterized by its effect on these quantum amplitudes, leading finally to quantum mechanical output amplitudes, from which we can derive essentially the entire physics of the system, in particular the conductances. And that's exactly how we describe the system theoretically. the particular beam splitters, mirrors, and in fact also the waveguides where electrons acquire a Rochebach spin-splitting dependent spin-dependent phase can be characterized by scattering matrices, which these scattering matrices have to be spin-resolved because we have a spin-dependent situation. So output amplitudes of each of the two terminal devices that we are having to create in order to build the Mach-Zehnder interferometer are related to incoming amplitudes by some reflection amplitudes and transmission amplitudes, which have spin indices, basically distinguishing reflection with out spin flip and with spin flip. And interesting issues arise due to the fact that Rochebach spin splitting leads to a coupling of the spin direction to the orbital motion for eigenstates. For example, if we look at the scattering at a beam splitter, then we can imagine sending in an electron in an eigenstate, Rochebach eigenstate, which has spin polarized perpendicular to the waveguide that it is moving into. Now, after the electron scatters, there will be some partial wave that's being transmitted, which again will have its spin perpendicular to the propagation direction and be in eigenstate. However, the reflected partial wave will have its spin now pointing parallel to the propagation direction, and therefore has is a superposition of the Rochebach eigenstates. And similarly to the case where when we looked at the spin transistor now, in for the reflected wave, a spin precession will occur. Now, this particular fact that we have this mixture of eigenstates or scattering states for reflected outgoing states is essentially embodied in the scattering matrix, which is not diagonal for reflection, but it is diagonal for transmission.
What are the dimensions of this device that you assume?
The entire Mach-Zehnder interferometer has to be has a size of the order of the spin precession length. Otherwise, nothing interesting would happen.
Okay.
And I can talk about numbers later on. Go ahead.
If you just look at a single mode ring,
yes.
ring
yeah. mm-hmm.
would this be an example for a much safer?
Not quite, because it's. I mean, this is a four terminal. It's a four terminal device rather than two terminal. Yeah.
Okay. So this is not really.
That's right. Okay, so what we can do then, we can write down such scattering matrices for each of the elements of our Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And
yeah. Let's assume that every single vertical or horizontal line is a compass.
You mean this?
There are no physical borders in the sample that we talk about.
So the Mach-Zehnder interferometer is this phase coherent structure, and eventually you will have contacts, yes. I mean, this is how you will inject electrons later on. I mean,
why don't you have processes which involve scattering not from the mirror but from walls or corners?
Ah, sorry. So this is a one-dimensional waveguide. Let's say quantum wire. Let's say this is a point contact. And if we say that we look at ideal beam splitters, then there is no backscattering. So there would be a contact somewhere here, injecting electrons, you know, if you raise the voltage over here, for example, and these electrons propagate in my waveguide, get scattered at this beam splitter according to what we expect a beam splitter does, namely dividing it into two separate parts.
The entries are adiabatic constrictions which
Yes, exactly. So like in the Hanbury-Brown-Twiss experiment, of the Stanford group. Yeah. Okay, so essentially by writing down the scattering matrices for our beam splitters, mirrors, and also for the propagation in interferometer arms, which leads to the accumulation of spin-dependent phases, we can derive a scattering matrix for the entire spin-dependent Mach-Zehnder interferometer just by algebra, and so in fact this can be done analytically, and this sort of, you know, entire total scattering matrix contains all effects due to having spin precession of the reflected waves and the accumulated phases of states that have not precessed but stayed in eigenstate, but nevertheless, of course, will accumulate dynamical phases as they move along, which depend on their spin direction. And from that scattering matrix, which I don't want to show you exactly, we can look at what the conductances are in this four-terminal device. So from the scattering matrix, we just square the entries, we find the linear conductances. And so there are various possible scenarios, you know, conductance for what I would call reflection or, you know, transmission in that interferometer. And in fact, turns out reflection is symmetric, but transmission actually has two different conductances associated with it, depending on whether we look at the crossing of spin channels or conservation of spin channels. And giving you these formulae, but don't look too much in detail of what they are. Just notice that all these conductance coefficients are actually oscillatory functions of the dimensions of the interferometer, so the width and the height of that interferometer enter as parameters. However, they are compared to the length scale, LSO, which we call the spin precession length, which can be tuned by external gate voltages. So this spin precession length is related to the strength of spin orbit coupling, basically in an inverse way. If it's we have strong spin orbit coupling, we have a short spin precession length, and vice versa. So essentially, this is the answer for linear transport in the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And I want to go.
Is this for a single channel?
Yes, it's for single channel, yeah.
So if we go back to the pen, how many channels we have, like two in the case?
Okay, so if you have many channels, so the phases that are accumulated in your Mach-Zehnder interferometer and the spin precession, etc., is essentially the same, close to being the same, because the spin Rushbar spin splitting actually is linear in K. However, what you do have to be careful about is If you have more than one subband, you have hybridization between different subbands. So at these degeneracy points, things are different. So then one would have to make amendments to these phases that you accumulate.
What are those number of parameters, W and H?
Oh, those are the width and the height, measured height and width of the Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So essentially in the...
Do we permit it to be longer than the LSO?
That should be, yes, can be longer. I mean, in principle, the theory doesn't care how long it is. It's oscillatory in these ratios of height and width with LSO, but...
I would be worried about that, because when you scatter from the smear, if you take very long distances, then you can have two eigenwaves,
yes,
of your Hamiltonian, which will travel slightly different directions. So if one will hit the point of contact and will be able to form ballistically, the other is completely lost.
Then we have lost, in fact, one source of interference, and that's why I'm looking at lowest subband single. Let's say ideally 1D quantum bias. When we introduce the finite width, then all these scattering processes indeed have to be included. Yes, I mean the basically backscattering can occur, of course, and in particular the hybridization between different subbands has to be included. Yeah,
right. I'm afraid that the cosine functions are a bit of exaggeration.
For the lowest 1D subband, it wouldn't be. I mean, if we have spin orbit coupling much stronger than...
For long subbands in the scattering region, you have point contacts, you have some quantum dump. You want to scatter from one point contact to the other point contact, not losing any intensity.
Yes.
So for this, you need to hit the contact within a very small angle.
That's why I would suggest that the experimentalists actually build quantum wires to connect the point contacts. I mean, what you are thinking is that in between here, we have like a 2D electron gas, and we have just point contacts that sort of channel.
How about the square, which is your unit block?
Yes, indeed.
So if this is much larger, or if it is larger than LSO, I think you will start losing...
I mean, the point contact, no, I mean, that's true.
Well,
I mean,
the point contact, the region on which we have this building block.
Yeah.
The region where you scatter with the mirror.
That's right.
To be less than the
LSO. You mean this?
Oh, any of them.
That's true. I mean, certainly, whenever, I mean, if I have a smooth confining potential on the scale of LSO, I have very strong pathological effects. I mean, that's why my waveguides in the parameter have to be much thinner than the spin precession length. And also, you're right, of course, the point contacts. Any sort of my quantum optical elements has to be, in its size, much smaller than the spin precession length. I mean, the ideal thing that I'm envisioning is that the entire interferometer, this has to be of this order of the spin precession length.
All the lines are actually one-dimensional.
Yes,
wires.
Yes. Okay. Yes, indeed. Okay, so under this, in this situation, we can then actually look at special cases where we take a sample that has a particular height and width that is of the order of the spin precession length, and we can actually realize a device just with this system by adjusting the spin precession length. So, for example, in a system that we have realized that is square, so the width of the interferometer is the same as the height, then when the height is equal to the spin precession length and also the width, then the system is rather boring. Basically, whenever we have height or width being in multiple of the spin precession length, the Mach-Zehnder interferometer acts like as if it wasn't there. So, for example, spin in any electron with any spin injected will just be transmitted. However, if we now apply a change to the gate voltage, which will tune the spin precession length and make it such that now twice our interferometer dimension is equal to the spin precession length, then this changes the interference in our structure, and in fact the system goes from being completely transmitting for any spin to be completely deflecting for any spin. So any electron that we inject in this situation due to spin-dependent interference will actually be reflected. And so that allows us to implement something that is quite analogous to the spin transistor that we have discussed before, except that we do not have the need for any magnetic injector or analyzer leads, simply by adjusting the strength of spin orbit coupling and therefore affecting the spin-dependent interference, we can actually switch between an on and an off state if we take as a signal the output level of one output level of this Mach-Zehnder deformator. So in some sense, what we can do is we can actually tune the dark, we can switch the dark and the light outputs of a Mach-Zehnder deformator by affecting this spin-dependent interference, which is not something you can do optically. And so this essentially allows you to do spintronics without magnets. And also what is possible to realize is to take a differently shaped interferometer, so aspect ratio 1 to 2. And in this system, if you make the same manipulation where we start with the system having height equal to the spin position length and then change it so that it's essentially half that, then this will actually realize a phase shift for any incoming electron, basically reversing its spin. And this is essentially something like a single qubit operation that you can do in this system. Anyhow, so partly based on that, but also just for a general interest, we were then motivated to look at the relation possibilities that exist for linear electron optics and the possibility to do quantum information processing in systems of electrons that do not interact. So typically in quantum information processing, what you need to do is you need to be able to manipulate your quantum bit, and you need to basically have realizations of non-trivial 2-qubit gates, and most suggestions, solid state suggestions of 2-qubit gates are based on the interaction between quantum degrees of freedom. And however, manipulating the interaction can be a tricky thing, so might be benefit to actually think about a realization of quantum information processing based on linear electron optics, which would be analogous to things that the colleagues from photonics are doing. So that actually attracted much interest because it was an influential paper where the authors discussed the possibility to realize the entire suite of quantum computing, basically the exponential speedup of classically hard computational problems, if one just knows how to operate linearly on photons. So essentially the photon is a flying qubit, an extended quantum mechanical degree of freedom, and polarization is degree of freedom is the quantum qubit that we are looking at. And essentially they said that you only need to be able to make these photons, detect them, and to make any linear devices, beam splitters, phase shifters, etc., and then you can actually realize any non-trivial quantum information processing algorithm. So again, we know electrons are waves too, and would be interesting to ask the question whether the electrons themselves could be flying qubits, with their spin being the quantum degree of freedom in which we do the information processing. And so the initial question to that was actually disappointing. Turned out that in a system of non-electron fermions, there's no efficient quantum computation possible if you just allow for linear fermion optics, which means, you know, beam splitters and phase shifters, similarly in spirit to what I have discussed before. But more recently, that total pessimism has been revised. Namely, it turns out if we allow one more ingredient, namely the possibility to detect the charge of electrons, which in principle could be done without affecting the quantum degree of freedom spin that we are using to build the quantum information processing protocol, then the full power of quantum computation, efficient quantum computation, is actually restored. So in that context, we were interested to see what happens when we look at two electron interference in our Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Now for that, it's clear that it's not just a simple generalization of the single particle interference that I have discussed before. Fermi statistics affect scattering. Instead of we just have a single particle and let it go through a beam splitter, then you know we have a 50-50 chance that the particle shows up in each of the either of the output channels. If you have two distinguishable particles, these basically scenarios overlap. However, if we have two indistinguishable fermions, then it is clear when they enter the beam splitter, then out in each channel, one electron will enter. This is just simply the Pauli principle that mandates this outcome. And if we now translate this into the situations that we can encounter in our Mach-Zehnder interferometer, where we send in two particles, there are several different possibilities that can arise. One is basically where we have two electrons coming in and they are basically interfering, etc., and the Pauli principle acts, but at the output we will discover electrons in the same state that we would have if we had just sent one electron in by itself. So this is the rather boring situation. However, there are Mach-Zehnder interferometer setups where this does not happen, but additional basically output configurations are generated by the fact that we have electrons sent in, two electrons at the same time, and the Pauli principle is projecting out certain possibilities. So in the following, I'll actually be interested in looking at the following scenario, where basically electrons are injected, two electrons are injected in one of the interferometer arms, and we are looking at the output having one electron in each of the arms. Okay, so just very briefly, the theoretical description is essentially scattering theory. Again, we have a four-dimensional single electron space, spin quantum number, and essentially the arm of the the arm of the electron interferometer. And we can go through the easy algebra and find out that if you look at the two-particle Hilbert space of system that has this four-dimensional, for a single particle, you have actually a six-dimensional space. And this can be nicely parameterized using a basis based on Baire states, which, you know, of course, of the, those are six. And the only other thing that we need to then describe two-particle interference is to know what happens actually when one of these basis states, for these Baire states, is incident on our electron optical elements. So essentially, these electrons in these superpositions of two particle states comes to these electron optical element, and each of these phases will be, or amplitudes will experience some scattering, some phase change, and this all can, however, be easily calculated using the representation that we have of electron optical elements from our single particle interference studies. So essentially we can derive two particle scattering matrices in the basis of these magic Baire states that tell us, for example, that this G4 state, when it's incident on this beam splitter, it comes out with basically as itself with a phase factor attached, and this can be done for all the other basis states as well. And essentially, one can again derive a two-particle scattering matrix for the entire interferometer. One can obtain this analytically, and it is again oscillatory in the size divided by the spin precession length, similarly to the case that the single particle scattering matrix was.
So to make it realistic, we need to assume that the size of this bulk is less than spin precession length.
For each quantum optical element, again, has to be smaller than the spin precession length, yes. So the beam splitter is much smaller than the spin precession length, yeah.
In your calculation, in what order is the order coupling constant to get finished with the time constant?
In which order? I mean, the scattering matrix has these oscillatory factors, sines, cosines, so if you wish, first order.
This comes from...
from the phases, exactly, from the phases that are... Yes, exactly, yeah, yeah.
From the beam splitters, does inorbit coupling matter in your calculation at all?
Not in my calculation, where I write down the scattering matrix of this point.
This is completely potential.
Yes.
In other words.
Yes, yes, indeed. Yes, exactly. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you have to worry about electron-electron repulsion here?
In principle, yes. In practice, so the electron is in an extended state, so essentially one would have capacitance effects if I make my Mach-Zehnder interferometer smaller, smaller, and smaller. In the Mach-Zehnder interferometer, the electron is extended on the size of the interferometer, so I expect that in the spin precession length is of the order of, let's say, 100 nanometers and such. So it is not like a single electron transistor where I would have strong charging effects, but in principle, you're right.
Very extended.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I may just quickly maybe come to the punchline to not, so if we look at a Mach-Zehnder interferometer of some rectangular shape, has certain size L, let's say measured in units of the spin precession length, the small L, and has some aspect ratio A, if we look at the what happens if we send in two electrons, basically such a wave consisting of two electrons in this non-entangled state, then due to the interference, two-particle interference, there will be a superposition of two particle states at the outputs with some rate or some amplitude in states where we have two electrons per output. So, for example, like here, this is a similar one for the other output, but there will also be a amplitude for having electrons coming out in basically one electron per output channel. And so the interesting point is whenever we have this scenario where we send in two electrons in this non-entangled state and the output state is such that we have a single electron per channel, then this state of these two electrons is maximally entangled in their spin degree of freedom. So by calculating the concurrence, this is what you can prove. Now the question is, okay, that's fine in principle if we then introduce a charge measurement in addition to basically our interferometer setup, some point contact, etc., which tells us each time when we do this experiment, it's actually sending in this two electrons, it will return a value 0, 1, or 2 for the electron occupation in this arm, for example. Whenever it returns the number 1, we know that the two electrons that are coming in these two different channels will be maximally entangled. Question is, how often does this happen? And it turns out one finds that this efficiency for entanglement generation, which is equal to the probability that a scattering occurs of such an incoming state into a state where the two electrons are separated in the output channels, depends on the size of the interferometer measured in units of the spin precession length and the aspect ratio, and in fact that its maximum is 50%. So 50% of the time that we basically do this experiment, we will be able to extract entangled electrons if our interferometer has a particular basically size and aspect ratio. Now, the nice thing, however, is that along these lines, we can actually change the efficiency of this entangler simply by adjusting the strength of spin orbit coupling. So this little L was the size of the interferometer, which is given, of course, by the experimental setup, but divided by the spin precession length, which can be adjusted by adjusting the brush bar spin splitting. So it is actually possible to switch this structure from 50% efficiency to any value in particular, also to switch it off.